Being extremely hard on ourselves is very common in the kind of high stress and anxiety space, because that's kind of what got us there in the first place. Now I love using the word curiosity. So when I get into these instances, I go to a curious place and say, is this necessary? Does it really impact other people? Do I really care? You know, the people that are impacted, do I really care what they think? You know, because so much of our struggle in life is caring massively about what other people think of us. And the reality is that for me, there's, you know, a handful of people in the world that actually, you know, can affect my emotions in terms of what I think. And so, you know, catering to everybody else is to my own detriment.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Before we start, I just want to share two quick things with you. If you have guest recommendations or stories that you think we should know about, shoot us an email at hello@unmistakablemedia.com. We love hearing from our listeners. And if you're looking for a keynote speaker for your event or want to bring our team at Unmistakable Creative to your event or organization for a workshop on creativity and productivity, visit unmistakablecreative.com/speaking, send us the details, and we'll be in touch. And as always, today's episode is brought to you by our friends at HostGator. Whether you're looking to start a new website or move an existing one, HostGator can help. They have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email, an easy-to-use website builder if you're not too tech-savvy, and if you want to move from an existing host to HostGator, they make it free and super simple. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. Tim, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it is really, really my pleasure. You know, I came across your story by way of our mutual friend, Philip McKernan, and you and I actually met at Philip McKernan's event. And when he, you know, sent me a list of people that he recommended to interview, he recommended you in that batch. And every single person he's recommended has been phenomenal. So it's kind of a no-brainer to have you here. And of course, no pressure at all. But I want to start by asking you, what social group were you a part of in high school? And what impact has that had on the choices that you have made with your life and your career?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think the social group I was part of in high school was the popular one, although I was kind of having to pretend to be somebody else to fit in, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I never felt like I was naturally part of that group. It was like, right, how should I talk? What should I wear? How should I be to kind of assimilate with these people? And I spent a lot of my life doing that. Mm. Yeah.
How do you resolve that tension between this sense that you know you're part of this group, but you don't feel like you're part of it, and you're having to put on an act in order to be part of it?
I think that's something that I didn't figure out until I was 35 years old, was that my whole life had been about pretending to be somebody else to try and fit in with the crowd, from high school to my professional career. And then finally, as we will talk about when I get into my story, I think the pressure of having to wear the mask, or the pressure of having to be somebody else, eventually caught up with me. And I was like, I need to actually just be myself.
Yeah. You know, it's weird. I mean, I think, you know, I had the similar realization probably around 35, 36. And you kind of wonder, why is it that we don't have that realization when we're, you know, young? I remember... Mm. You know, the kinds of things that I would do in order to fit in, you know, like I went out for the football team in seventh grade and I got the shit beat out of me on a daily basis just because two friends of mine went out for the football team, because I lived in Texas where they're literally seventh graders the size of grown men. Mm. You know, I mean, all sorts of goofy things. Like I remember, you know, when we had a fifth grade dance, I asked my dad to buy me a pair of sunglasses for the dance because I thought it would make me cool and that way I could talk to the prettiest girl in class. And, you know, it's only, you know, looking back as an adult that I recognize that we do this. And I'm wondering why you think it is that it takes so long before we come to that realization.
Mm. You made me think of something for the sports analogy. I used to play ice hockey and ended up playing to quite a competitive level. But when I first started, because I'm pretty tall, I'm 6'3", and I got into a bit of a ruckus with somebody and punched him in the face. I wasn't a goal scorer because I wasn't naturally talented. But when I got all the teammates and all the fans were like, oh, that was amazing. You should do that more often. So, you know, I instantly became a bit of a goon. But again, just fitting in and liking the validation. I think we have this kind of never ending search for validation where, and this maybe answers part of your question, for a lot of our lives, it's like, pat on the back, Tim, good boy, well done, off you go. And I needed that for so long until I decided or started to cultivate it for myself. Mm-hmm. In my life, it took until I was mid-30s, because that's just how long it took to break me before I realized that I just was forced to change. I had to do something different.
Mm. Well, I think that makes a perfect segue. So to start talking about, you know, what it is that led to you to your change and to your breaking point and to the work that you're actually doing today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I, kind of moving on from that, from my youth, when I got into my working life, I continued to aspire to things which were kind of put in front of me by other people. So it was like, you know, I remember my dad used to phone me up and he was like, how's work going? So I was like, oh, work's important. Better do more of that. So I was always trying to get pay rises and make more money and aspire to kind of get to the next level. That seemed to be my pursuit. And I did that for a long time. And this was in the late 90s kind of dot-com boom time, when, you know, the boss would come in on a Friday with a bottle of vodka and say, right, whoever does the most sales calls today can start doing shots in the office. And then whoever did the most deals in the month, you can borrow the Ferrari for the weekend. And it was very boiler room tactics, which was exciting then. And I thought, you know, this is what life's about. It's just about cranking out the cash. And my lifestyle grew along with that success. So every time I got a pay rise, I'd say, right, now I could maybe buy a nicer car or a bigger house. And so, you know, I believe that we tend to grow into our pay rises. It's very hard to get more money, or it used to be hard to get more money and say, I'm not going to do a bit more with it. So after like 10 to 12 years in that industry, I became the vice president of sales for a technology company. I had a team of people under me. And I kind of started to feel pressure in that role. I started to feel like my boss was like, what are the sales numbers? And then we'd hit the sales number, and the first of the next month, it was like, right, what are you going to do this month? Like the never ending hit your target message. And so that pressure was building up. I also had children at this point. So I started to feel this kind of dual stretch, one from the office saying, get in here, Tim, when are you going on the next trip? Do another presentation. And then my wife and kids saying, why are you never here? And why do you even go to work? Even when there's a foot of snow on the ground outside, you still have to risk your life for this very important job. And so that built up one day till I created this kind of perfect storm in my mind of neglecting myself on so many fronts. I flew from Toronto to London to do a business presentation for a partner. And I did what I'd always done, which was get off the plane, go and meet my friends and go and drink as much as I possibly could in the amount of time I had. That was kind of a badge of honor back then, was like, we could go out and get shit faced and still wake up the next morning and do a good job. I'm not sure what we were thinking, but that following morning, I woke up, went to the coffee shop, double espresso with a hangover, walked into the room, and kind of went to start this presentation, and had what I call is a sort of M&M moment, where I started to launch into my spiel, which I'd done 1,000 times, and I had a panic attack, the first panic attack I'd ever had. I had it there in that moment. Initially, I didn't know it was a panic attack. I just thought I was dying because my heart felt all sporadic, and I started to sweat, and I started to shake. I felt like the room was spinning, and this was happening kind of 100 miles an hour, but the people in the room are all looking at me, and I'm like having, you know, I've gone inside and I'm having all these thoughts and fears, and I want the ground to open and swallow me up. So that's kind of, that was the first time that I got a big slap in the face. Hmm. Yeah.
So keep going.
Yeah, so I'm kind of in that moment. I wanted to run out of the room, so I did. I walked out of the room, and I The irony is I was in a high security IT building, so I couldn't actually get out, which was kind of weird. So I went up to the guy that had brought me in and said, give me a key card. I need to escape. And he was like, didn't your presentation just start? And I was like, yeah. So I'd also just hired a country manager for England. It was his first day on the job and he'd come to watch me do the presentation. So I had all this pressure I was loading onto myself. But I went into the restroom, splashed some water on my face, and started this catastrophizing story in my head of now I'm going to lose my house and I'm going to have to pull my kids out of private school. I'm going to lose my cars. And within, you know, a couple of weeks, I'll be divorced and living on the streets probably as a result of this meltdown that had just occurred. So I was going full on beat the shit out of yourself mode. Mm-hmm. You know, they finally found out that you're a fraud, Tim. They finally figured it out, which goes back to your original question of what I was like in school. And that was, I went back into that room and kind of I had this like honesty, almost like I just couldn't lie. I just went back into the room and stood in front of the people and just said, look, I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know what just happened. I'm really sorry. I'm going to try and do my best to scrape through this. And my legs were shaking so much, I sat down. And it was like every word I said, my throat was just open enough just to squeeze it out. And I got through that day. I'm not sure how on reflection, but went back to my hotel room that night and lay down on my bed and just cried. And I feel like years of suppressed emotion sort of poured out of me. And I just laid there for a few hours. I phoned my wife and told her what happened. And all I really wanted was to go and see my mum. And my mum lives in England, so I could have figured that out. I just wanted to go and see my mum and be taken care of again, you know, just have her like look after me, and she would have made me a cup of tea and all would have been well in the world. But I couldn't do that because I was still in the shame zone. So I was still just beating the crap out of myself for failing, really, for just letting everybody down. Even though in reality, I didn't, you know, it was blown out of proportion in my mind, but that's what anxiety does. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that was the biggest incident. And then, you know, and then everything started to change in my life after that.
Okay. So many questions come from that. This tendency to beat ourselves up and to, you know, make things mean something that they don't. You know, I only know this because I have this tendency. You know, for example, I had a conversation with my business partner last night about priorities, and he said, I want you to know something. This is not, you know, resentment in any way at all, or a jealousy or envy. And he said, I know you well enough to know that you'll ruminate on something and it will turn into all of these stories in your head. And he said, just know that it's none of those things that you're probably, you know, going to start ruminating on. So I'm curious, how do you develop that ability to not take a situation or circumstance and make it mean something, that sort of stimulus response that happens, you know, without even conscious awareness necessarily, you immediately launch into this beat yourself up story.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's, well, I think the first thing is awareness. Mm-hmm. So, you know, back then I didn't have the awareness that I have today. And so I believed that I should feel pain. It's almost like sometimes I think people feel like they need to feel some pain to kind of, you know, beat themselves up a bit for whatever's going on. But being extremely hard on ourselves is very common in the kind of high stress and anxiety space, because that's kind of what got us there in the first place. I love using the word curiosity. So when I get into these instances, I go to a curious place and say, is this necessary? Does it really impact other people? Do I really care? You know, the people that are impacted, do I really care what they think? You know, because so much of our struggle in life is caring massively about what other people think of us. And the reality is that for me, there's, you know, a handful of people in the world that actually, you know, can affect my emotions in terms of what I think. And so, you know, catering to everybody else is to my own detriment.
So did you leave this job immediately after this happened?
No, I didn't. I did what we normally do, which is I struggled for a bit. as our mutual friend Philip McKernan would say, we kind of people will change when the pain gets bad enough.
Yeah.
And my pain wasn't quite bad enough, so I endured for a bit longer. But yeah, it was very awkward in the office. I actually went into the business and said, look, I don't want to be vice president of sales anymore. I want to be vice president of business development. And everybody in business knows that VPs of business development is a bit of a stealth job where you can kind of pretend to be working and off you go for a business meeting and you got the office door shut because you got some very important phone call, which ends up nothing happening. And so I thought that's perfect because I can just hide indefinitely. And so I did that for a bit and I would shut my door and do that kind of thing. But it was just like my commute was an hour each way to work. And for the whole hour there, an hour back, I would be in agony with my stomach churning and just feeling so incongruent with the life I was living, that eventually I did leave. Eventually I went into my boss and just said, listen, I don't want to work here anymore. I can't do this. And he was, you know, we got on extremely well and had a good relationship and he kind of tried to talk me out of it and eventually realized that that wasn't going to work. So yeah, I did leave. And part of that, came from the fact that, you know, first of all, I didn't admit that I had anxiety. I was like, it must just be stress. And then second of all, I thought that anxiety was sort of a chronic condition. And then eventually I came to the realization that my life had caused it. And so in order to change, you know, my feeling, change my emotion, I had to change my situation. So leaving the job was the first part of that. Mm.
You know, this is a question that has come up for me a lot, and that this idea of why is it that it takes often so much pain for change to occur in our lives? Like, why is it that we often have to have pain as the catalyst and it doesn't change until we experience significant pain?
Yeah, I mean, I come across this a lot because I don't even think humans learn vicariously very well. I mean, there's loads of, you know, 20 somethings today who listen to your podcast or mine or other things and pick up on concepts. But until we've actually been there and felt what it feels like to be in that situation, I mean, literally, you know, because of the income that I was generating from that job and the reliance I felt that the people had on me, it was easier to bury it for a long time than actually make a significant change. But now looking back, I'm almost glad it happened because it forced me to do something different. It would have been desperate to carry on like that, kind of oblivious for so long. But yeah, I think, you know, it's like a lot of things in life. Human nature just seems to be that we need to be told we've got diabetes or we've got a health concern in order to actually take charge and do something different. Mm. Yeah.
So, you know, I want to talk quite a bit more about the entire sort of idea of anxiety because, you know, I think in a lot of cases, you know, from what you're telling me, it sounds like there are people even who are not aware that they have anxiety. They just feel like this is who I am and this is how I operate. So I'm curious kind of one, you know, how we define anxiety first, because I think by defining it, we can start to figure out how to work with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So great question. And I've always been a sensitive person. When I think back to childhood, and I think for me, my anxiety was sort of, I think of like a volcanic river under the earth, and eventually it just erupted through and became a bigger thing for me. But I think it was always there, in that I believe that people with anxiety kind of have this extra sensory perception. They feel more, they're more aware of human interaction and conversations, and just they see more stuff going on, and that could be beneficial, that could be a superpower, but it could also be a limiting factor when you're thinking about negative thoughts or intrusive thoughts or things that you don't want to feel or experience, and you can't break that loop. But to define anxiety, I think, is essentially, you know, elevated amounts of fear which don't naturally dissipate. So of course, as humans, we're all designed to feel anxiety. It's what keeps us alive. It's what makes the species endure. But once the threat has passed, or the threat that wasn't real in the first place, we know that it wasn't real, but we can't move on from that. I think that's where anxiety becomes a thing, and people get caught in that, in the circle of fear.
Mm-hmm. Today's episode of The Unmistakable Creative is sponsored by our friends at HostGator. So maybe you have a creative project that you want to start and you have no idea where to get started or can't figure out even what the first step is. And I always say one of the easiest first steps is to just buy a domain name or to start building a website. It doesn't even have to be a complicated website. It can just be a picture and a bio about you. And fortunately, our friends at HostGator are fantastic for helping you to get started. They have an easy-to-use website builder if you're not too tech-savvy. They have 24/7 live support via phone chat and email. And if you have an existing website that you want to move to HostGator, they make it free and super simple. And they're offering 30% off all of their hosting packages for Unmistakable Creative listeners. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. And if you're looking for a speaker for your event or organization, or you want to bring the Unmistakable Creative team to your event or company for a workshop on creativity and productivity, just visit UnmistakableCreative.com/speaking, fill out the form, and we'll get back to you.
So naturally, the next question then is, how do you break the cycle, or how do you reduce it and overcome it?
Yeah. So one of my mantras, one of my taglines is stop coping and start changing. Mm. And the reason I say that is because I believe the system today is designed around coping. And is part of the reason I'm doing the work I do, because I just think if somebody wakes up tomorrow, has their first panic attack, their default is going to be to go to the doctor, as we do, and the doctor's going to say, here, take these pills, and the person will take the pills. It'll put a Band-Aid over the actual anxiety, so there's nothing being resolved, and then we've got, at some point, a dependence on the medication and withdrawal symptoms and side effects that come along with that. And then there's a whole host of other stuff, like whether it's deep breathing techniques and even things like meditation to some extent in isolation aren't the answer. So when I look at – when somebody comes to me and says, I've got anxiety and I can't do interviews, or I can't get on airplanes, or I blush, or I, you know, struggle in relationships – the first thing I do is I say, great, you know, that is, we know what the kind of manifestation of your anxiety is, but tell me about your life. And what I find is that much like if you're driving a car and you neglect to put air in the tires and you don't take care of the suspension and so on and so forth, eventually the steering wheel will start to shake. The alignment is off, and our life is no different. You know, when I dig into people's stories, it's relationships, it's environment, it's the workplace, it's often things that, you know, beliefs that they had growing up, and I'm almost like an investigator of people's lives to figure it out. And there's often things that we can do to address the actual outcome, whether it's, you know, techniques to overcome the anxiety. But the meaningful change is done at the origin point. The meaningful change is done in terms of, if we fix the alignment, the anxiety reduces. And a combination of those things, whilst also cultivating some new confidence, cultivating some belief in ourselves, is what means that we can embrace the anxiety and say, this is actually a part of me, and I'm going to pick it up and move on with my life.
I'm curious, you know, we've been talking really a lot about the sort of inner work that has to get done in terms of overcoming anxiety. I'm curious what impact the sort of outer habits and day-to-day things that we do, like our use of technology, our screen time, you know, what we eat, exercise, sleep. What are the links between that and anxiety, and you know, what has your work shown around that?
Huge. I mean, massive. You know, a lot of, so if we start with exercise, if you think in terms of the fight, flight, or freeze response, if you picture the gazelle running across the Serengeti or wherever it is, being chased by the lion, the gazelle will lay down and go into a freeze state. And when mammals come out of that, they shake, they jump around, they quiver, and they do all this stuff to flush their nervous system. that's why exercise is so beneficial for us humans, is because when we experience emotion and cry and shake, we're told to calm down. We're told to stop. We're told to, you know, we're given a Kleenex and said, don't cry. People say, don't cry. But that's the natural way that we reset our system. So when we're very energetic, whether we're doing, you know, a sprints or we're lifting heavy weights, that allows our immune system to get that workout. I also work with cold water therapy. It's why if you get in a freezing cold shower in the morning or jump in a cold ocean, that you come out and feel so good afterwards, because it's flushing. It's basically flexing your nervous system like a muscle and testing it and then resetting it again. So it kind of builds resilience over time. So there's lots of things that we can do externally. Food also is absolutely huge. I talk about, you know, starting really at the basics. I use an acronym CATS, which stands for caffeine, alcohol, tobacco, and sugar. Basically, none of those are good for anxiety for reasons of stimulating or suppressing our, you know, as stimulants. They're either lifting us up or putting us down, which doesn't feel good. That's not to say that people with anxiety can never have a cup of coffee, but it's kind of one of the easy places to start if you're feeling anxious. Mm-hmm. And then from a food point of view, I've, you know, in my own life gone through, I've tried every diet under the sun, mainly to try and regulate my weight. But when I was trying to feel better, I started to get into paleo style diets. And then, you know, as is the more recent craze, for the last couple of years, I've been on a ketogenic diet, and I've been following the work of some of the leaders in that space. I read a book a couple of years ago by Dr. Perlmutter, which is called Grain Brain, mm-hmm. Which talks about inflammation in our systems as a result of gluten, which contributes to early onset Alzheimer's and dementia and those sorts of things. And so if it contributes to that, can it also make a difference with depression, anxiety, and other things that we feel? I believe absolutely so. And the bottom line is that when we consume diets high in carbohydrates and sugar, especially refined sugar, our blood sugar levels going up and then dropping off in a big way simulate a lot of the anxious feelings that we have. So for me, it's about putting people on eating regimes that provide them with slow burning, consistent fuel, so they don't have these ups and downs of hunger and excitement and all the rest of it. So absolutely can have a huge impact. And then the more kind of holistic therapies, I believe journaling is huge, meditation is huge, and just creating space. You know, a lot of the work that I've done on myself in terms of whether it's attending retreats or taking time out has really been the most impactful, because we're kind of, especially in the entrepreneurial world, we're always rushing to the next thing or trying to get the next idea complete, whether it's updating the website or launching a new product or finishing a book, as you're doing, you're experiencing that at the moment. But building in time into our lives just to leave the phone switched off on the desk and go for a walk in nature. I'm lucky enough to live by the ocean, as you do, but or walk into the forest or walk into the park or wherever it is, and just be on your own with your thoughts again. That is a rare commodity and becoming increasingly rare.
You know, it's interesting. You know, you talk about making space. I've realized more and more how important that is. As you know, I was forced to spend 5 days or so completely unplugged because I was volunteering for a nonprofit on Montana that one of our listeners runs, and there was no internet or cell access there. And for the first 8 hours or so, it was kind of annoying. And then I thought to myself about 9 hours in, I thought, you know, this is something we should do more often. This really makes you a much better person.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've read like Cal Newport's book about deep work, and yeah, I believe it. In order to actually, you know, a lot of people are like, how do I find my passion? And they go from one blog post to the next podcast to read the next book. And I'm like, when have you actually fucking like just had your own thoughts and written them down on a piece of paper and created enough time to know what you think without absorbing everybody else's thoughts? So, yeah, I think that, you know, the way that the technology is going is that your ability as a human being to disconnect and to be on your own is, you know, and this sounds ridiculous to say it, but you're going to be, you know, in a very small rarefied space if you can consistently do that.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. And I think the benefits of it are really interesting. I'm curious, kind of in your own work, what have you found about the relationship between technology and anxiety?
It's high. I mean, a lot of the people that I work with, both one-on-one and in my retreats, they wake up to their cell phone under the pillow or next to them. At my worst, I would wake up for a pee in the middle of the night and check my email at 3 a.m. because I had customers in different countries. And your internal world is so much being dictated by the things on your feed, that you're handing over control of your destiny to something else.
Wow.
And in line with, you know, in America, all the recent political stuff that's been going on, and whether you voted for or against that, I don't watch the news. I don't turn the TV on. I don't turn the radio on in the car. My dad might say, well, that's, you need to know what's going on in the world, Timothy. You should be paying attention. But the reality is that we're so connected today is that A, I find out anyway, uh-huh, at some point, and B, I don't need to be plugged into that all the time. I need my own space to process my own thoughts.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So I'm curious how this whole experience of dealing with anxiety, leaving the job, all of that has impacted your relationship with your wife, and also how it's changed the way that you raised kids.
Mm. Great question. So, now I get to work from home, and I do go away and travel to speak or to run events and stuff, but I'm around a lot more, and they tell me that that's a good thing, because I just wasn't around a lot before. But we've kind of, like, as a result of the stuff happening to me, we've kind of collectively invested more in all of our health. I came back to, you know, I left my job and I spent a couple of years investing in real estate and starting that as a kind of passive income side business, but came back to the anxiety story because as I started to tell it, I realized that it's not talked about enough. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the default of medication and kind of burying it effectively is so prevalent for lots of reasons we won't go into, but it's so prevalent. There needs to be more voices around holistic approaches or ways that people can kind of interact with that. And so, yeah, so I just started day one, putting it out there. And as we do in this kind of, we have the absolute privilege today in this entrepreneurial space of creating something we love that has meaning. That's really just what I've kept doing. And one story I'll tell you is that my eldest son, who's now 11, last year had a school project and he had a little pre-filled form and he had to fill in who his hero was and why and all the rest of it. And he said, my hero is my dad, because my dad's dedicated, you know, at least the current work that he does to helping other people who are struggling in their lives, helping people with anxiety, and he's created a business doing that. And I just broke down like a bowl of jelly when I read that, because it's such a, you know, we often tell our kids to do this or do that or try and be this, and you know, as the widely used Gandhi quote goes, you know, be the change you wish to see in the world. And through doing my own thing, that's the best education or the best guidance I could ever give my children, is to say, follow your heart. You can create something from nothing and you can help other people. So that was huge for me.
You know, so a lot of parents listen to our show, and I'm curious, based on this experience, what advice you would share with them?
I think it's allowed me to deepen my relationship with my kids by just being more truthful around them. I think prior to that, as an adult with children, I was always like, you know, trying to pretend like I had all my shit together all the time. and that I really wasn't struggling and that everything was okay. And when they had a problem in their lives, I would say, don't worry, it'll be fine. And, you know, since all this stuff's happened, I've had a lot of occasions where, just recently I got an email from a listener or from a client, telling me that I've changed their life. And I was just sat at the kitchen table reading this email and I started crying. And my two oldest boys were like, why are you crying? And I said, I said, this email I just read, it's, you know, it's very emotional based on this lady. And I shared it with them and then they've got tears in their eyes. And so I think, you know, not trying to be something other than just myself around them has made our relationship so much closer. It's so much easier for them to come to me now with their own struggle. Because I said, you know, I say to them, like, my life isn't perfect. And I don't feel great all the time, but I do a lot of things in my life to you know, put me in the right direction and build something that a life that I love living. And so, yeah, I think it's just being truthful or speaking my truth allows them to speak theirs.
So I'm curious, how you think about money, differently after this experience. Cause I mean, you know, if you're a VP of sales and, you know, you're doing what you were, I'm guessing you were probably making a decent chunk of change. So I'm always curious as to how somebody's story around money changes after something like this. Like, did you give up making a lot of money and did you take a significant, you know, pay cut to go and do this? And how have things changed, you know, with your relationship to money as a byproduct of this?
Yes, I would love to talk about that. So I was making a lot of money before, but it felt hollow. So I would make a lot of money. I would spend a lot of money and I kind of didn't really appreciate it. I just thought, of course. And I would often go into my employer and say, I heard so-and-so at another firm is making more money. I need a pay rise. And they'd say, okay. My friend, a very good friend of mine coined the term. We had this in-depth discussion one day over coffee and he coined the term grass-fed cash. We're in this culture so much today of like grass-fed beef and all this healthy, naturally raised food. And so we're having this discussion around the creation of money through doing work which has meaning, this sort of organic, beautiful work which impacts people and changed lives and feels good. So to get paid to have a livelihood as a result of not just, you know, some people talk about money as energy. So not just receiving the financial tangible stuff, but also the goodwill energy. Because as you know, some people listen to your podcast and they'll never spend a penny with you, but you may change their life. You have changed their life in some way. So sometimes you get paid in just that good universal energy, and sometimes it's actually in money. But that was kind of our conversation around grass-fed cash. Is imagine if you live a life full of, you know, abundance on the basis of producing great things that help people. That just feels so much more powerful than just creating money for the sake of it at your detriment.
So two last questions for you. One is about books, and this has always been really interesting. If there's one book that you could recommend to our audience that has profoundly influenced your life, what would that be?
So for me, this is a bit of an obvious one for many listeners, but I go back to the 4-Hour Work Week with Tim Ferriss. And the reason of that one is it just was the first inkling of like, oh my God, there's a different way to do this. It doesn't have to be in an office in a suit every day, which was what I was doing at the time. And so that got me dreaming and pondering about the possibilities of like, maybe I could create something which means that I could work from different locations or work at different times of the day and build something for myself.
So I'm going to extend the question. What is an uncommon book that you'd recommend? Something that doesn't normally come up that is on your list?
That is a good question. Yeah, I mean, I go to another, you know, Stephen Pressfield, The Art of War, which talks about resistance, but it's not really an uncommon book because lots of people know that one. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I have a great uncommon book. I think I've read so much stuff at this point that and most of my stuff these days is around, you know, here's an uncommon book which is profoundly changed me, but it's very recent. It's by Robert Whittaker is the name of the author, and it's called now I've totally lost the name of the book as well. Anatomy of an Epidemic. But it talks about the fact that modern medicine and how we treat mental disorders or neurological conditions has really only been around for the last 50 or 60 years. Mm-hmm. And prior to that, people were healed on a much higher, much more effective rate with holistic therapies. And so we're going through this full circle where we realize that things have been pushed for kind of big business reasons as opposed to what's best for the people. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, inspires me to you know, raise my voice and talk more about the stuff that I'm interested in.
Well, this has been really, really thought-provoking and eye-opening and insightful, as I expected it would be. So I have one last question, which I'm sure you've heard me ask. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think the thing that, for me, that makes people unmistakable is their vulnerability. I'm very blessed in my work in that when I speak and tell my story, it attracts people's truth. It attracts people to open up and tell me what's going on in their mind, what's going on in their lives. And so I think, you know, when I hear that, it's like, it's just beautiful. And it allows me to connect to them, you know, more than you would ever connect to people without it.
Mm. Well, this has been awesome. Where can people learn more about you and your work?
Yeah. So a couple of places, anxietypodcast.com is my podcast where I talk more about anxiety and life and that kind of stuff. And you'll find lots of resources on there. My social media handle is Tim J. P. Collins. So you can find me on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook. Connect, say hi, and yeah, get in touch.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.